See if I still remember how to do this podcast thing. Welcome to another episode of the Abnormal Psychologist Podcast. This is your host, who's been missing in action for a while, Dr. Colby Taylor. I'm an associate professor of behavioral sciences at Christian Brothers University in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm also a licensed psychologist in the state of Tennessee. And I recently got my license renewed yesterday in the mail. I got some exciting mail. Your mailbag emails are always exciting, but this was physical mail. And it was licensure until September of 2025. So I'm good to go for another 2 years. Sorry that it's been a while since I recorded an episode. It's been a busy start to the school year, a good start to the school year. I really enjoy my students. I'm enjoying the classes I'm teaching, but I've been pretty busy. And not just with teaching. Like on Monday next week, we're in September. I'm recording this episode at the end of September. And September is National Suicide Awareness Month in the United States. And so I'm participating on a panel on Monday night. It seems like this has been a semester of presentations. I have one at Vanderbilt next month on some of my autism research. And then I have one in D.C. at the beginning of Washington, D.C. at the beginning of November. So it's been a very busy semester. We're in fall now. If you hear a beeping during this episode, that means my coffee is ready. I'm brewing some coffee right now, and it's like autumn maple coffee or something. It's not pumpkin spice. I think I've mentioned, there's the beeping. I don't know if you can hear it. I mentioned sort of fall fetishism before. I think it'd be really interesting to do like a future episode on the psychology of fall and sort of pumpkin spice latte culture. But that's not the focus of today's episode. Today we're going to talk about reading. And way back in season one, I did an episode on dyslexia. And this is sort of going to go back and talk about dyslexia and the teaching of reading a little bit. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to that episode and then come back to this one. So this is based on a mailbag request from Michelle. Michelle said, "Hi, Dr. Taylor. I know this isn't super psych related, but I saw in your school bio, which is on cbu.edu, the Christian Brothers website, one of your interests is reading fluency." Yeah, that's actually what my doctoral dissertation was on. "Can you please tell me the major things you would look for in making a differential diagnosis between dyslexia and visual processing disorder? Thank you so much for all the knowledge you've imparted so far through your podcast. If you have time to answer the question as well, I would really appreciate it." This is a really good question, Michelle. I don't know why you say it's not super psych-related, because I think I mentioned this in the dyslexia episode, sort of the holy grail in psychology, or one of the holy grails in psychology, is understanding how people read. That if we're able to understand how people read and all of the neural processes that go into that, we probably have a much better understanding of so many other facets of psychology. Just through our understanding of reading. We have a long way to go in understanding reading. And I'll talk about sort of the unconquered, unexplored frontier of reading in this episode. And this episode is going to be one that involves scandal. It's going to involve controversy. So that'll be kind of cool. It'll probably be controversial. So if you disagree with something I'm saying in this episode, I'm happy to hear about it. Send me an email. CTAYLO41@cbu.edu. You can label it as hate mail instead of mailbag and tell me why you disagree with this, because this is a very contentious topic. So contentious that we call it the reading wars. So the reading war sounds really dramatic, but it essentially describes this conflict that's been brewing in reading for over a decade. And the two main armies in this reading war are the science of reading. That's one camp. And the science of reading just sort of sounds like, I don't know, that they're more scientifically minded, and they will claim to have more empirical evidence than whole reading. So we have the science of reading, which is sometimes called just sort of phonics, versus whole reading. And that sort of parenthetical other name for the science of reading, phonics, is one of the main contentious points between whole reading and science of reading. So when I grew up, when I learned to read, and my mom was a second grade teacher, so she taught reading, phonics was super, super important. We had phonics cards that we would do, right? And it would have something like TH makes the th sound. I remember very vividly there being like a picture of a Canadian goose on the th sound, because geese, right, when they get angry, they go, right? And we'd learn how sounds correspond to different letter patterns, like TH in the sound. And we would have dedicated phonics lessons every day, first, second grade, for, 30 minutes a day. But somewhere along the way, phonics got dropped in a lot of reading curricula. And one of the reasons that phonics was dropped and didn't get as much emphasis from reading teachers is because of this whole reading movement, which means that we don't necessarily have to teach the component parts of reading, like phonics and like decoding. Instead, we should just read language naturally because we're naturally wired to acquire language, to read language. And then sort of between the science of reading army and the whole reading army, we have this balanced reading that's sort of in between that tries to say, oh, you know, phonics is still sort of important, but whole reading is great too. And it's sort of, a compromise between the two camps. This reading war highlights that there's a gap between the science of reading, and not just the science of reading as the name of one of these warring parties in this reading war, but like evidence that we have about reading and then how reading is taught. And it's really, really troubling that studies about reading don't align with how children are taught to read. And we see this a lot in psychology, not just with reading, but with like research on therapy and depression and anxiety. And the fact that research doesn't always align with practice, we call the practitioner-researcher gap. And that's something we want to try to close, where practitioners, and this is sort of why we have the PhD model of psychology, that with your PhD, you have to do a doctoral dissertation. Again, mine was on reading fluency, that you're able to produce and consume research as well as practice. And so you're up to date on the most empirically supported, evidence-based treatments and assessments and all that stuff. And we're seeing this gap in reading. Reading is a super important topic right now. Reading scores are dipping in the United States. They've dipped since the pandemic. According to NAEP data, and NAEP, if you're educationally minded, NAEP data is really important if you're a classroom teacher or a school administrator, stands for National Assessment of Educational Progress. And only a third, 33% of fourth graders in the United States are proficient in reading. This is 2022 data. It's the most recent data that we have. And only 31% of eighth graders are proficient in reading. So well over half, well over two-thirds of fourth graders and eighth graders are not proficient in reading. And this is nationally, but here in Memphis, where I live, we're especially experiencing precipitous drops, not just in reading, but in math too. And it's really, really troubling. 2022 data was released last October. So I imagine that 2023 data will drop in the next month or so. And I also imagine that we'll continue to see this decline. So it's really important that we discuss topics like this, because we continue to see dips in reading and math, yet we're teaching kids the same way that we have for a decade or two, and this is not working. Speaking of education not working, I promised some scandal at the beginning of this episode. So this scandal is going to involve Lucy Calkins. So Lucy Calkins was an instructor at Columbia University's Teachers College, and she was really big into the balanced reading movement. She was more in the whole reading camp than the science of reading camp, and she developed these curricula that many schools in the United States adopted on teaching kids to read. And a lot of these curricula did not, until very recently, like the last year or two, involve phonics in their lessons. And this is troubling because we know teaching phonics is very important in teaching kids to read. So like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, Lucy Calkins, again, who developed these curricula that are really popularly used throughout the United States in teaching reading, and she had this multi-million dollar research lab at Columbia University Teachers College, and this made national news. She was dropped by Columbia. They pulled the plug on her multi-million dollar program. And there's all this talk right now that Columbia University, which is loaded, they have a $13 billion with a B dollar endowment, that Columbia might be potentially liable for harming generations of children learning to read because of Lucy Calkins' curricula that she developed. Columbia recently has tried to distance themselves from the Teachers College and be like, hey, we're a completely separate entity. Us with our $13 billion, we're sort of associated with the Teachers College, but not really. So they're trying to distance themselves from Teachers College and from Lucy Calkins. And whole reading and balanced reading that lacked phonics teaching was far-reaching. Again, we're talking generations of students that weren't taught phonics. And this continues today. A recent survey said only 22% of kindergarten, first, and second grade teachers support teaching phonics separately. Only 22%. Yet we know phonics, again, because of the science of reading, is vital to learning to read. The New York Times published an article called The Myth of the Natural Reader. With whole reading, there's sort of this notion, again, that we're naturally wired to attain language, and that sort of if you surround yourself with books, especially books that are appropriate to your reading level, that you'll sort of absorb that knowledge from the books and learn to kind of read on your own. Essentially, reading would be autodidactic. It would be sort of self-taught to an extent. That might be a little bit of a straw man argument about the whole reading movement, but I don't think it really is. Exposure is essential to whole reading, right? If you're exposed to books, if you're exposed to reading, if you're exposed to language and vocabulary, reading for most people will come. That's sort of one of the gists of whole reading. And there is something to exposure to books and reading. So my wife's study, she's part of a longitudinal study called CANDLE that studies neurocognitive development. They used to do home visits when kids were 2, 3, 4 years old. And they would go into houses and they would count how many books are within a children's reach in the house. So how many are sort of on eye level or below. And we know that exposure to books is associated with reading gains down the road. There's been some generalizations of this research that said a home library for children needs at least 80 books. And this has kind of been the impetus for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. I know here in the United States, as soon as you leave the hospital when a child is born, you fill out this form. A lot of times it's like in the discharge paperwork for the hospital to sign your kid up for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. And every month, Dolly Parton, or I don't know if it's every month, but it seems like it's every month, you get a free book in the mail. Again, exposure to books is really important, but it's not everything. Also part of this whole reading movement is leveled reading. So I don't know if you remember when you were growing up going to the school library, and maybe you had accelerated reader where you could read certain books. The books in my library had like little blue stickers on their spines. And the stickers would say how many points the book was worth and then the grade level of the book, right? Oftentimes when kids take reading assessments, they're assigned a certain reading level. And it usually is, you know, they're maybe reading at a fourth grade level and they're only in second grade. And if they're reading at a fourth grade level, they should be allowed to read fourth grade books. So leveled reading is essential to whole reading. And I do think there's something there. I mean, it goes back to sort of Lev Vygotsky and the zone of proximal development, right? We want kids reading appropriate text. We don't want kids at sixth grade reading levels reading second grade books. And we don't want kids at third grade reading levels reading ninth grade books. Sort of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. We don't want too easy. We don't want too hard. We want just right. So I do think there might be something there with leveled reading. So to sum up whole reading, reading is a holistic process. We're naturally wired to read, and reading just sort of happens organically and uniformly in the brain. Now let's contrast whole reading with the science of reading perspective. So at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned to Michelle that reading is sort of the holy grail of psychology. And one of the reasons it's the holy grail of psychology is that it involves so many components. Reading is a multi-component process. It's a diffuse process in the brain. There are so many different regions of the brain that are involved in reading, which leads to so many places that reading can go wrong. So the science of reading is going to break reading down into its component parts and say that if any of these parts go wrong, think about a machine or a car, if any part to a car goes wrong, you're going to have problems with the entire system. and that we need to teach and build each part individually in order to have a smooth running system. And so we're going to see a lot of metaphors. We're going to see a lot of infographics from the science of reading perspective. And two infographics in particular I'm going to talk about in this podcast. The first infographic I really like is Scarborough's Reading Rope. So Scarborough's Reading Rope, and you can Google it. It's an infographic. It presents reading as a rope. And there's rope strands or fibers that are sort of intertwined together that eventually lead to reading comprehension. So imagine on the left-hand side of this graphic, we have very loose strands that are just starting to sort of spiral together. And then in the right hand of the graphic, we have sort of a tight, spiraled, fully put together rope. And at the end of that rope is reading comprehension. Reading comprehension is sort of the ultimate reading process. It's what everybody wants. I get so many reading teachers that would come to me and say, can you give me an intervention for reading comprehension? Because reading comprehension is what's measured in NAEP data. It's what's measured through standardized testing. They're not measuring phonics. They're not measuring phonological awareness. They're measuring reading comprehension. And so teachers obviously want to be able to teach their kids reading comprehension, but it's not that simple. Usually when readers are struggling with reading comprehension, it's not actually reading comprehension that's going wrong. It's one of the building blocks to reading comprehension that's going wrong. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So Scarborough's reading rope, right? You have these ropes or strands or fibers that are intertwined, and they eventually lead to reading comprehension. And reading, again, is multifaceted. It involves many strands. And some strands or fibers, you know, clump together more closely than they clump together with other strands. So imagine in this infographic, one clump coming to this rope equation is language comprehension. And then another clump that's sort of starting to wind with language comprehension is word recognition. And so within language comprehension, we have different individual fibers. We have fibers of background knowledge, vocabulary, language structures, verbal reasoning, and literacy knowledge. So those are all sort of in the clump of language composition. And then language composition starts winding, it starts tying together with another clump called word recognition. And word recognition also consists of like individual fibers, fibers of phonological awareness, of decoding, and of sight recognition. And so it's through the twining of language comprehension with word recognition that we ultimately get higher order reading processes like reading comprehension. So that's one infographic, Scarborough's Reading Rope. Another infographic, this is one that I learned in graduate school, is the five pillars of reading. So the five pillars of reading is developed by the National Reading Panel. And essentially, in order, imagine like sort of pillars, but dominoes that are together, and you need each pillar in order to be able to ultimately get to, just like in the reading rope, reading comprehension. So the first pillar of reading is phonemic awareness, sort of broad awareness of sounds, right? When you're working with a 3 or 4 year old, you're teaching them to rhyme. You're teaching them to start different words with the same letter. So like alliteration, assonance, like repetition of vowel sounds. These are all really important to phonemic awareness. The next pillar is phonics, which we've talked about phonics, teaching the association between sounds and letter combinations. Then we have fluency, which is the ability to read accurately, quickly, and with appropriate expression. So sort of reading automaticity. We have vocabulary thrown in. You need vocabulary to be able to read. And then ultimately, we have reading comprehension. As you can see from these infographics, which you're not looking at, so you can't really see them, but as you can maybe understand, reading is not sort of a whole language light bulb magically coming on process. So where did reading instruction go wrong? Again, I was taught phonics. I was born in 87, so I was in like elementary school learning to read, 1992, 1993, 1994. Where did things go wrong? And one of the ways that we can figure out where things went wrong, where this researcher practitioner gap came in, is through the What's Hot survey. When I say What's Hot survey, I imagine somebody saying it in like a Paris Hilton voice. But the What's Hot survey is compiled by a researcher named Jack Cassidy. And it's the degree of attention, not necessarily the degree of importance, that reading research gives to certain topics. And in the early and mid 90s, so I must have been like the tail end of the phonics generation, whole literacy became the craze in like the mid 90s. We see phonemic awareness and phonics fall off as what's hot topics into the early 20-teens. And then only recently, only like the early 2020s, have we seen this resurgence of phonemic awareness and phonics. So if my listeners are in college right now, odds are they might have been taught through a whole literacy perspective because they were sort of in school when the whole literacy craze was going on. Unsurprisingly, with the What's Hot survey, comprehension is always hot. And vocabulary so sort of goes in and out of hotness. Vocabulary experienced a brief period of hotness in the early 2010s, and then sort of fallen off in recent years. Send me an email if you were taught phonics, or if you're a teacher, whether you teach phonics currently or not. If this piques your interest, there's a really well-done podcast, way more well-done than my sort of janky podcast. It's The Science of Reading. And the science of reading has actually probably led to the resurgence of the science of teaching reading. And we actually think that the Science of Reading podcast is reflected, like you can see the influence it's having on the What's Hot survey. So Science of Reading podcast, check it out. The mailbag request from Michelle specifically asked about visual processing disorder. So visual processing disorder is a little bit controversial. And I think in my next episode, I'm going to talk more broadly about sensory processing disorders. So visual processing disorder would be a type of sensory processing disorder. Sometimes you'll see them called sensory integration disorders. And there's debate over whether these exist and what they look like. The DSM-5 text revision does not include sensory processing disorder. So it's not something necessarily that many people in the medical community recognize. Occupational therapists tend to recognize sensory processing disorder. Some speech language pathologists recognize sensory processing disorder, but it's something not widely recognized in mental health and physical health communities. Specifically, what visual processing disorder involves, again, is sort of up for debate. There's some ophthalmological papers about visual processing disorder, but some people conceptualize visual processing disorder not as like something being wrong with your ocular system, but with something being wrong with your brain's ability to process your ocular system, right? So we want to rule out that there's not like a genuine ophthalmological problem that's going on. And this is not going to get you special education services. So in the United States, visual processing disorder is not really recognized as a special education eligibility category, whereas specific learning disorder, under which dyslexia falls, is recognized as an eligibility category. So we might be dealing with dyslexia here. And so I sort of mentioned that reading has many component parts, many places that reading can go wrong, whether it's phonics, phonemic awareness, fluency, what have you. Which has sort of led people to come up with different types of dyslexia. And I'm always very skeptical when I hear somebody come to me and be like, there's 10 different types of dyslexia and I have this type. Some of these types are go back to the Orton-Gillingham model of reading. Orton-Gillingham, the Orton is named after Samuel Torrey Orton. Samuel Torrey Orton was a medical doctor who's a physician. Early 1900s, studied learning disabilities, specifically reading, and he came up with the topic of strephocymbolia, which I mentioned in my dyslexia podcast. Strephocymbolia is sort of the misconception, but he thought it was sort of a defining feature of dyslexia. The dyslexia involves letter reversals, that if you're dyslexic, you might see letters backwards, and that's why you reverse letters. We know through over 100 years of research that most people with dyslexia, a vast majority of people with dyslexia, don't experience letter reversals. You still see the witty bumper stickers like "Dyslexics of the World Untie." That would sort of be an example of strephocymbolia. Samuel Torrey Orton, pioneer in dyslexia research. Many of his ideas now are sort of under scrutiny and might not be right, but at least he was exploring it. So one of the things he championed was multisensory teaching. And I think I've mentioned before that types of learning, like kinetic learning, are you a kinetic learner? Are you an auditory learner? Are you a visual learner? Those are pseudoscientific. There's no evidence to back up that we have like different learning styles and that lessons should be tailored to students' learning styles. Anyways, one type of dyslexia, according to sort of this Orton-Gillingham school of thought, is surface dyslexia. And so when you're describing visual processing disorder, this sounds a little bit like maybe surface dyslexia. Surface dyslexia is where you have trouble with rapid automatic recognition of surface words, so sight words. They don't come naturally to you. Most people, when they see sight words, they don't have to sound words out, right? They come rapidly and naturally. In fact, in some of my research, we use what's called rapid automatic picture naming, which gives 100 pictures, maybe over 100 pictures to a kid. And there's like, you know, a ball and a comb and a key. They're pictures. They're not words. There's no letters involved at all. And it asks kids to go through and label, to say out loud what each picture is as fast as they can. And we think that kids that struggle with this task are at risk for having dyslexia. We also know with sight words, sometimes people call this word calling. Teachers used to get really scared that if we don't teach phonics, which we should be teaching phonics, kids will become word callers, meaning that they'll just sort of use their memory and not their sounding out skills to figure out what words are. And so sometimes when you see like a 3 or 4 year old that's quote unquote reading, they're not actually going left to right and tracing text and reading based on component letters. Instead, they might have seen sort of the McDonald's logo before and are like, that says McDonald's. They're not necessarily reading it. It's just sort of rapid association. Okay, we don't have very good evidence to back up that there's multiple types of dyslexia. Maybe in future decades, because there's so many component parts of reading, we'll be able to like classify you into a certain type of dyslexia. But I would be very, very skeptical if you go to somebody to get an evaluation and they're like, you have type 7 of dyslexia, and that's what that means. There's just not enough data. We struggle enough with what dyslexia is to come up with these different types of dyslexia. So be a little bit skeptical if you're labeled with like surface dyslexia or something like that. Again, reading is super controversial. There's some big players in the reading world. One of them is the International Dyslexia Association. And sort of some interesting trivia about the International Dyslexia Association, the IDA, it was originally called the Orton Dyslexia Association, again, after Samuel Torrey Orton. And sort of to tie this all back together, tie it all back together, no pun intended, Hollis Scarborough, who came up with the Reading Rope infographic, won the Samuel Torrey Orton Award, which is the highest award that the International Dyslexia Association gives. She won that award in 2009. And so revisiting Scarborough's Reading Rope, you probably fall into the word recognition clump. So you're saying that you have visual processing disorder, but you're probably really struggling with that word recognition clump of fibers. And my hunch is that your difficulties in reading are probably tied to again, no pun intended with the reading rope. They're probably tied to the fibers of decoding and sight word recognition. So in my differential diagnosis, I would be heavily favoring a dyslexia diagnosis. I never really give visual processing disorder as a diagnosis just because there's no diagnostic code and it's something that I don't think there's enough evidence out there to necessarily diagnose. If you do think something's going on with your visual system, you know, I would recommend that, and before I do any reading evaluation, before I do any sort of evaluation for a specific learning disability, I want recent hearing and vision screenings. And in your case, I think a recent vision screening would be very important to rule out there's not something ophthalmological going on. There's a lot of resources that are out there. So I mentioned two infographics. I mentioned the Science of Reading podcast. There's the Heschinger Report, I really like for education-related news, and a lot of education-related news relates to reading. So the Heschinger Report, H-E-C-H-I-N-G-E-R. And then Emily Hanford's podcast, which sort of started the reading wars or if it didn't start it, it definitely threw some fuel on the fire. Emily Hanford's At a Loss for Words podcast series is also really, really good. All right. I think I'm at a loss for words for this podcast. Don't really have anything in the mailbag. Send mailbag requests. Send, you know, this is a very controversial topic that people feel very strongly about. Send thoughts, send hate mail, send episode ideas to CTAYLO41@cbu.edu. I think I'm going to do my next episode on another controversial topic sort of related to this, and that'll be sensory processing disorder or sensory integration disorders. But send me other episode ideas. And until that next podcast, take care and stay well.